Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our briefing this afternoon on more flights, less fuel, to hear about how the Defense Department is deploying energy efficiency and renewable energy, how this is a very important part of meeting the mission of the Department of Defense and the branches, the various branches of our services. We are very glad to be able to bring you this briefing this afternoon. I think that you will hear very, very interesting things from a very exciting and very experienced panel. And we are proud to be sponsoring this briefing with our co-sponsors this afternoon, E3G, as well as Operation 3. And I just wanted to mention that E3G has done a very important report that was released earlier this year called Degrees of Risk, which is about risk management applied to climate change and a strategy framework for how to do that. This afternoon, we will hear from a panel really looking in much greater detail about the kinds of examples that we are seeing throughout the Defense Department that are being used in facilities and base installations, as well as out in the field as well. And all of these things, I think, are important in terms of what they tell us about the kinds of opportunities that are there, how these technologies, in terms of improving our efficiency in different ways, and as well as really tapping the vast amount of renewable resources that we have, the kind of difference that it can make in terms of addressing our security on many, many fronts. And to chair our briefing this afternoon, I want to turn to Sherry Goodman. We feel very fortunate that she is able to be here with us this afternoon. Sherry is the Senior Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary of CNA, where she also is the Executive Director of CNA's Military Advisory Board. And she brings a great deal of experience to this issue. She also worked in the Senate on the staff of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and she also served for 8 years in the Defense Department as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security from 1993 through 2001. Sherry?
Thank you, Carol, for your leadership with your great team here on the Energy and Environmental Study Group. It's my privilege this afternoon to introduce to you Senator Udall, who carries on a great tradition of bipartisan and innovative leadership in national security and energy. And that's why I feel a special privilege in being able to introduce him to you today. And it's great to see such a wonderful group here assembled. I guess it's better to be in here than anywhere else on a day like this, or caught up in other more difficult political debates going on today. Senator Udall brings both a great family tradition and a great tradition from his own state and commitment both to energy security and to our military forces, which I think is incredibly important at this time, these challenging financial times as we work to set our own country and financial house in order. We have to make sure that our energy security and the military readiness of our troops all continue along the same path and continue to maintain the effectiveness of our forces as we modernize them and improve their energy efficiency and military effectiveness. Senator Udall follows in the great tradition, which I was privileged to serve with on the Senate Armed Services Committee when Senator Nunn was chairman of that committee, and in the early post-Cold War period really brought environmental security and awareness of energy to the forefront of our military forces. And I'm very pleased that Senator Udall is continuing in that tradition. And thank you for your leadership.
Thank you, Sherry. You're too kind, and I, too, am very excited to see the number of people in the room here. It's standing room only, SRO, which is fantastic. And Sherry also mentioned that there are other things going on the Hill right now, and thank you for giving me a respite from the I should say, the discussion we're having. I know that some of you, well, there aren't too many people long in the tooth here like Evan McGinn and me. Can I throw you in with me, Danny? But my father, Morris, served in the House for 30 years. By the way, he was pretty suspicious of the Senate, but that's a whole other conversation. But he used to say, if you can find something everyone agrees on, it's probably wrong. And right now, the problem is we've got something that nobody can agree on, and I think that's also wrong. But I'm thinking about Churchill's great line. He said, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And it seems like we're in that mode right now. But Sherry mentioned, I serve on the Energy Committee and the Armed Services Committee, and it's quite a combination for me, two areas of policy that I love. And I actually, now I'm also on the Intelligence Committee. My kids say that's an oxymoron, Danny, anyway, those three committees give me a bird's eye view of both the opportunities and the challenges that we face in this crucial area of national security and energy independence. And there's certainly no more crucial link or linkages between energy and our economy and our national security. I think that's why we're here today. And nobody better understands the true cost of fossil fuels and foreign oil than those who serve us in uniform. And that's why I think it's so appropriate we have senior DOD leaders and veterans here. Drew and I had a little exchange. I started talking about the Academy, and I was talking about the Air Force Academy. It has a wonderful now PB array, and he was clear that it better be West Point or nothing. But we'll let him carry on that conversation with you all. But in Colorado, we do have significant military assets and personnel, and I'm really proud to represent those people in our state. But it's not enough to be proud or grateful. We've got to do something. We've got to be forward thinking. And I'm reminded that our troops have performed amazingly well under tough conditions for over a decade. And I really stand in awe of them. But they have their limits. And one of those limits is energy. I would say I don't think there's any limit to their courage, but there's probably limits to the energy that they have access to. You don't have to read very much about this to know that a quarter, and the Admiral may correct me at some point, but a quarter of our casualties in Afghanistan and Iraq are tied to fuel convoys and supply convoys. And that led Admiral Mullen recently to say energy needs to be the first thing we think about before we deploy another soldier, before we build another ship or plane. It's the first thing that I asked Admiral Winnefeld, who's on tap to be the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and then yesterday General Dempsey, who's on in the queue to be the Chief of the Joint Chiefs, and the Chairman, they both agreed that saving energy saves lives. And I think that can be a hallmark as we move forward. We also have learned pretty quickly that by having lighter, more agile, more fluid, more flexible energy supplies, we're therefore more nimble, more fluid, more agile on the battlefield itself. So I'm excited about the work that's being done in the DOD, and I might just take the last minute I have to make a little commercial announcement. For those Hill staffers that are here and others who are interested, I want to pitch my bill, which is the DOD Energy Security Act. The acronym is DODESA. I introduced it again this Congress with Congresswoman Giffords, who has been a real leader in this regard. And a couple of the elements in DODESA I think would be interesting to all of you. It, one, attempts to remove some bureaucratic obstacles to smarter energy use and development within the Department of Defense. It provides the DOD with an ability to enter into 20-year fuel procurement contracts so that industry partners can recoup their investments. It's a great way to send signals to the market, but ensure those who invest their capital that they're going to get a return. And it takes some significant steps to ensure funding for energy management efforts like the Energy Conservation Investment Program. The acronym is ESIP. So I'd ask all of you here on behalf of your bosses to take a look at those proposals and help me generate additional support. We were able to move some of the provisions in the markup on the Senate Armed Services Committee recently, and the House as well, but I want to get everything in the Department of Defense Energy Security Act into law so the military can continue to do the great work they're doing. So, we need to think about energy now. We can't afford to wait until the next crisis that confronts us. I think we all know what we have to do. We know that the cost of the status quo inflicts on us. And in that spirit, each of you is going to make a difference in making this happen. I think this could be, I'm going to use this more broadly, I'm going to put all of us in one generation, Admiral, in here. This could be our greatest legacy, not just for the military, but for America in general, to find a way to be more energy self-reliant. I think green and clean, combined with traditional fossil fuels, is the new red, white, and blue. There's nothing more patriotic than we could do to ensure that we're energy self-reliant going forward into the 21st century. So enjoy the panel. I know they're going to have a lot more substantive things to say than I just did, but we're very fortunate to have them here. Thank you, Sherry, for the great introduction. Thanks to EESI for what it always does. And take a look at this great document that's a part of the conference here today. So thanks again. Good to be here.
Senator, great seeing you. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, we've just had our last panelist arrive, so the timing is perfect to get started. We have a really excellent panel today. Two senior DOD officials who are in charge of energy for their services. Richard Kidd, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army, and Tom Hicks, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy. And they're going to speak first, and then they're going to be followed by Drew Sloan, who's a veteran, has served in Afghanistan, and who is now at OPOW, a sort of leading scholar and actor in sort of the new energy economy. And then by Vice Admiral Denny McGinn, who not only is co-vice chairman of CNA's Military Advisory Board, but is also president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. So, Richard, since you just walked in, do you want a few moments to collect your thoughts? We'll start with Tom, and we usually let the senior service, the Army, start first, but we're going to give Tom, since he's here, ready to go. Tom has served in the Navy since March of 2010. He's a focal point there for all things energy and provided very great leadership, good background. He served on the U.S. Green Building Council before that, and he's also worked at EPA and within the Energy Star program. And I can tell you from my own experience, the Navy is extremely, extremely fortunate to have Tom leading their energy programs, and the Navy has emerged as one of the strong leaders today on energy and energy efficiency. And so it's really a pleasure, Tom, to have you here. And I will just note that last week the Deputy Secretary of Energy, Deputy Secretary of Defense Bill Lynn gave a very important speech. All of you who follow this should I recommend you take a look at it. Because he spoke directly to the point about the importance of energy security and energy efficiency to our military forces, and that our mastery of energy technology has enabled our nation to be a great power and has given us a strategic edge in the Cold War. And staying at the cutting edge of energy technology, he said, remains critical to our military superiority. And that's what both Tom and Richard will be able to speak to today, how they in the Navy and the Army are enabling their services to maintain military superiority by staying at the cutting edge of energy efficiency and energy security. Tom.
Great. Good afternoon, everybody. It's hard to believe, but, 235 years of existence and you're not the senior service, but that's okay. I understand. It's a pleasure to be here with you all, to see so many familiar faces and some new ones as well. And thank you, Senator Udall, for your leadership The DDESA is something I think is very interesting and important, and appreciate your efforts there. Thank you, Sherry, for all your efforts as well, and all the other folks on the panel. I'll just kind of get into kind of what we're doing, why this is important to the Navy, and then look forward to some questions afterwards, I think, after we all speak. The Department of Navy, just for point of fact, has 72,500 buildings. We have roughly 1 billion square feet. We have 50,000 what we call non-tactical vehicles, commercial vehicles, 900,000 roughly people in the Navy, Navy and Marine Corps. We have 280 ships, 3,700 aircraft. We use a lot of energy. We are a big enterprise. And as you look at our energy consumption,
that means the world just ended.
Okay. does that mean the debt ceiling don't? We can get on to other things. Okay, is anybody? All right, there we go. Good. I guess, I don't know if I've gone over my time, if that was too long. I'll just keep going. We use a lot of energy. 2% of the total energy in the government is attributable to the Department of Defense. About a third of that is the Navy. But when you look at our profile specifically, 75% of our energy is used to power the fleet. But no matter how you look at it, when you look at our petroleum use, for example, it is very clear that as a Navy, and I would argue as a Department of Defense, as a country, we rely far, far too much on fossil fuel and specifically far too much on foreign sources of oil. This dependency degrades our national security, it degrades our energy and economic security, and ultimately causes harm to the planet. Now, recognizing the Navy's dependence, the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, in October of 2009, laid out five ambitious goals for us. One was that by 2020, half of our energy would come from alternative sources. Also in 2020, and that's both for the fleet and for the shore, half of our installations, we have 100 installations in the Navy, so 50 of those installations would be net zero energy by 2020. By 2015, we'll reduce our tactical or our petroleum use in our vehicle fleet, the 50,000 vehicles I mentioned before, in half. And then in 2012 and 2016, we'll deploy what we call the Great Green Fleet, a carrier strike group that we'll do in local operations in 2012 that is using 50-50 blends of alternative fuels, and then deploy that in 2016. And we'll also look to bring energy into the evaluation factors so that the future systems that we use and procure will be more efficient over time as well. So what are we doing about that? So I'm just going to touch quickly on what we're doing in those areas. So our philosophy is simple. So we look at our fleet, the 280 plus ships, 3,700 aircraft. Our philosophy there is pretty simple, which is looking for efficiency first and then looking for alternative energy. With regard to efficiency, we're looking, as these ships come in for dry docking, we're looking for hull coatings, propeller coatings, stern pots to make these things, make our ships more incrementally more efficient. But those ships and aircraft that we have today are largely going to be the ones we have tomorrow. And anytime we put a new ship into the water, roughly speaking, 40 years is how long that ship will be with us. Aircraft, about half as much. So the ships, again, and the aircraft we have today are largely the ones we're going to have in the future. So what else can we do? So beyond being more efficient, we can look at more alternative fuels, and we're doing that. I'll speak a little bit about that. But we can also make the ships that we are bringing online more efficient as well, and the aircraft more efficient as well. So one notable one is the USS Macon Island, which went out recently. It's an amphib. In its maiden voyage, it saved $2 million in energy costs, going from Mississippi to San Diego, and over 75% of its performance envelope it can go on electric power. That's the type of innovation I think the Navy is looking to bring in, and not just a single ship, and try to bring that out across other platforms as well. I'd also like to just mention and it's probably been, folks have heard this, many folks in this room, but for those who haven't, what the Marines are doing is part of the Department of Navy as well. And so last March, they invited industry to come in into an experimental environment to provide their technologies to see which ones might work for the Marine Corps in theater. The winning technologies, if you will, out of that in May were further tested in a wargaming environment, and then those technologies were equipped and trained up with the India Company 3-5 and brought into theater in September. So in just 6 months, we went from identifying technologies to using those technologies. And these are things that are enhancing our warfighting capabilities in theater, taking fuel out of the battlefront right now. So whether it's putting in solar blankets, whether it's putting in LEDs, renewable energy generators, or battery charging systems in place, it's enhancing the capabilities. And one example of that is, as we look at the what a patrol would normally use in terms of batteries, they would need a battery, what's called a battery refresh, every 2 to 3 days when they would go out on patrol. Well, with the systems they have now in place, they can go out for as long as 3 weeks. So that's really enabling them to conduct their missions, be more expeditionary, true to what they're there to do, and to use energy more efficiently. Well, similarly, one other piece. So I mentioned energy efficiency and what we're doing with that. But another big piece of this is alternative fuels. And just to put it in perspective, you know, why we're interested in this and why we need to be and need to look at alternative fuels and why fuels are so important. For us, every dollar increase in the barrel fuel is a $30 million bill to the Navy, and effectively. So this is really important for us to look at this going forward. And so this is an area that we spend a lot of our time on, looking at alternative fuels. Notably, last April, we tested the F-18 Hornet on 50-50 blend of biofuels and regular jet fuel, and ran perfectly fine. We now call it the Green Hornet. And we're going through the entire fleet of our aircraft and ships and testing them on 50-50 blends of fuel. And then also notably, recently, within the last month, on our behalf, DLA Energy has gone out with the what we believe is the largest contract ever for alternative fuels. And why we say we think, because there's no record out there to find if you're number one or number two, but we think for the largest advanced biofuels purchase in the world, we think, certainly in the United States, that we're trying to track down all the details on that, but there isn't a lot of folks out there that can validate that information. But we think it just kind of goes toward our goal of being more efficient and using alternative fuels. And we're also looking to expand and utilize the expertise and the authorities within USDA and DOE and the Navy to really provide, bring those together, unique authorities together, to hopefully accelerate more development in the advanced biofuels market. Well, similarly, ashore, you know, what we're looking at, again, the best kilowatt hour is the one we don't use. So we're looking to be more efficient there. And while we have to be more efficient in all that we do, renewable energy, whether it's because of mandates or our own goals, has to be central to our energy strategy there as well. And so over the last year, we've tripled our total photovoltaic production, and we have a goal of putting online more than 100 megawatts installed within the next year. We have 6 megawatts of wind. We have just put in place 1.9 megawatts of waste energy. We have a contract, or we're putting that online. We have another 3.2 going on at Miramar of waste energy. And these are just really important steps to go forward to really reduce that, our total energy consumption. And we're in the process of installing 27,000 advanced meters across the Department of Navy. And this will really give us an opportunity to manage, track, benchmark our energy use in ways we haven't done. I would also say the Navy is leading the way on geothermal energy. We have a 270-megawatt plant in China Lake, and we're looking and exploring areas in 29 Palms, Yuma, Fallon, El Centro, and others. I believe we have the only grid-connected wave buoy in Hawaii. I won't say it's enough to power a household. It might power your laptop. But I think it's an important step forward, and what's coming after that to really show the examples of what wave power can provide. And beyond geothermal and hydrokinetic technologies, I think, you know, Navy is playing a big role in not only energy efficiency, but the green side of buildings as well. So we were the first service to adopt LEED Silver, and as of May of last year, we require LEED Gold for all of our new construction going forward. And this is on top of energy standards that are already 16% more efficient than California's Title 24, for example. So those are just some of the things that we're working on. As we look at you know, the idea of energy efficiency, you know, it's often been described as a force multiplier within DoD. And I think, you know, as we look at being more energy efficient, I think a focus on our culture and our own behaviors is also a force multiplier for energy efficiency. And so as we go forward, you know, we're going to look to tap into and build upon, I think, a lot of the successes that we've had over the last several years in terms of the awards that we've received, and really drive this and embed energy into the culture, try to make energy personal, and you know, energy efficiency, renewable energy, alternative energy, try to get every sailor, every Marine, dependent, civilian, to really understand that connection to energy, and to our bottom line, to our national security, and ultimately to our warfighting capability. And we're going to accomplish these goals by tapping into some of the programs that we've been undertaking thus far, and some new ones that we'll be talking about here in the near future. I guess just in conclusion, I just want to thank the panel here. I look forward to the interaction here today and the questions that you may have. And with that, I'll say thank you.
Tom, that was terrific and shows us how the Navy is both at the forefront of technology and innovation for energy, as well as cultural change in behaviors and how we use energy, both of which are important not only for the military, but for our nation as a whole. Now I'm pleased to introduce to you Richard Kidd, who is the Army's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy and Sustainability. He's had many positions in the federal government. This is his third assignment as an SES, Senior Executive Service Fellow. He's a graduate of West Point. He's got a master's from Yale. And he's worked both at Department of State, Department of Energy, and now the Army is privileged to have him. And Richard, I hope you'll share with us some of what the Army announced last week in terms of its partnership with DOE on vehicle innovation, as well as backup power at military installations across the country, which I think is some of the great things that's happening in our Army today. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. Thanks for letting me collect my thoughts there just a little bit and get some intel on the Navy. So sit there and listen to what he's doing. It's great to see a lot of friendly and familiar faces here, various committee folks that I talked to when I was at DOE, and some friends and colleagues. I also see Dan Arvizo back there. He's not going to let me. I'm going to give him a shout out. He's the director of our country's National Renewable Energy Laboratory out in Colorado. It's a true national resource. So, Dan, thanks. Glad you're here. I won't talk too much about renewables since you know more than I do on any aspect of that. You know, Sherry asked me to just do a little curveball to talk about the alliance between the Army and the Army's TARDAC, Tank Automotive Research Development Command, and the Department of Energy. But I'd like to start that story actually and pay her a compliment and go back in time 3 years ago when there was an event sponsored by CNA and, you know, sandwiches and coffee and that sort of stuff. And on the margins afterward, Admiral McGinn and some others pigeoned me in the corner and said, "Richard, we really need an MOU between the Departments of Defense and Departments of Energy." And this was before the election. It says it doesn't matter which president wins, this MOU will be important to their success. So that was 3 years ago in the summer. It was hot, I remember that, and we talked about it for a very long time. Then we worked with the Departments of Energy and Defense to write an MOU, which was signed last summer. So this week represents the one-year anniversary of the Memorandum of Understanding between the Departments of Defense and Energy. And many of the things that you talked about, you mentioned, the TARDAC, the fuel cells, other areas of cooperation, the fact that Secretary Chu spoke at the Army Air Force Forum last week, this is all testimony to the value that the MOU has had, which was conceived and started up on the premises of CNA. So thanks for your push on that, and I think you should all take some privilege, some pleasure in that. So I'm supposed to talk for 7 minutes. I've just used two of them, so I'm going to do a 40-minute slide presentation in about 5 minutes, and we'll get to questions. You know, Thomas Friedman said, when the Army goes green, the nation goes green. The Army and the other partners, other services, the Department of Defense, have led the country in the past on social change. We've led on smoking eradication, gender integration, racial integration. And so when we embrace this issue of energy sustainability, and we will be a model for the nation. And that's a charge that I take very seriously, as does everyone else in the Army. And the Secretary of the Army and the Chief of Staff, in combined testimony to Congress last year, said, made mention, though, to remain operationally relevant and viable, the Army must reduce its dependency on energy, increase energy efficiency, and implement renewable and alternate sources of energy to remain viable. So this isn't about green for green's sake or being sustainable because it feels good. It's about the Army mission. It's about our ability to provide operational flexibility to our commanders in the field and here at home. It's about choice. All right. If we remain dependent and constrained, we lose choice. And commanders want choice. They want it in the field, and same with our installations here in the United States. The Army's special burden is that we are the largest user of facility energy in the federal government. All right. So we use over 20% of the whole federal government's energy that's used in buildings. And we do that in 164 installations, which are models of like the towns and communities all across America. Right? And then when we go to war, what is interesting is our primary consumer of energy on the battlefield is the generator, which is used to produce electric power to run the forward operating bases. Right? So in peacetime, 2% of the Army's BTUs are consumed generators. In wartime, 30%. Okay, so that is what is so, so the Army's sort of focus, if it does have a focus, we do have a focus, but the Army's sort of sweet spot, you know, the Navy will talk about biofuels and alternate fuels, and that makes sense for the Navy. The Army's talking about power, power production, power distribution, power efficiency. So we look at that, our strategic construct, we have a variety of plans out there. But we look at basing power, so the facility energy that we use on our installations here and abroad. Soldier power, the batteries that our soldiers carry just like the Marines. And vehicle power, both wheeled and aircraft, tactical and non-tactical. And as you look at those three areas of power and energy, the solution, the hierarchy of how you approach the solution is the same. First and foremost is you must change behavior, okay? Every soldier is a power manager. Right now, our soldiers are obsessive power managers when they go on patrol. They do not go on patrol without ensuring that they have all the fuel and all the batteries they need. So how can we turn that awareness into more energy-informed decisions across the Army? Well, one of the ways we're doing it is the same way as the Navy. We're putting on meters. Domestically now, we're able to provide mock bills on some of our installations to our brigade combat team, so the brigade commanders can see how they're performing over time and to their peers in the brigades to the left and the right. In Afghanistan, we're employing tactical fuel manager defense, which will allow us to get a full and complete understanding of energy at the point of consumption, not the point of disbursement, but the point of consumption. So with this information, we will start to inform the energy choices. So change culture. And I think you've watched the Army leadership. We've had a number of significant speeches and remarks over the course of the summer. More are coming. All right? And this is intended to put our leadership on record in such a way that will inform the whole Army, that folks will pay attention, and the Vice Chief of Staff, and the Secretary, the Chief of Staff, talk about energy. So after you change culture, the next thing you do is you drive efficiency across the enterprise, right? Efficiency savings, as Tom said, you know, the best energy, you know, cheapest energy is the energy you don't use. Energy efficiency improvements, both tactical and non-tactical environments are critical. They're cost-effective. They pay for themselves. And we're making a range of efforts to do that. On our building side, the Army has put in ASHRAE 189.1 as our building standard. So difference between a standard and a certification program, but ASHRAE 189.1 is a very prescriptive standard. We're the first federal agency to adopt this standard. Downrange, we're looking at the efficiencies in our operating forward operating bases. We've got a number of microgrids and other initiatives employed in Afghanistan. We are removing generators that do spot generation and looping them together. That effort alone is going to save over $240 million this year at 22 sites in Afghanistan. We've opened a systems integration laboratory where we're going to take two base camps, compare them side by side, one using a collection of new technologies, insulated tents, better generators, better air environmental control units, and then the standard set. And we're going to look at that in terms of energy, waste, and water to develop a standard protocol for what we believe will be plug-and-play applications and a model that will validate very clearly the different solutions that are out there. So after you change culture, after you drive efficiency, then you start to integrate renewables, right? Again, we're doing this here in our installations. The Army has over 130 renewable energy projects right now across our installations. We announced a few weeks ago that the Army Corps of Engineers has done a sources SOC solicitation for what could total up to $5 billion worth of renewable energy projects. There's going to be more RFIs and RFPs coming out from the Army over the course of the summer with some announcements this fall. And we've got a deliberative acquisition strategy to ramp up our acquisition of renewable energy. And we want to match that with improvements on our own internal business processes. Downrange, we are testing and deploying much of the same technologies that the Marines are doing. Solar shades, solar panels that go in the backpacks, portable fuel cells. We also, on our installations around Afghanistan, you'll see that our perimeter lighting and our perimeter sensors are all solar-powered standalone outputs, which has reduced dramatically the amount of fossil fuel, as well as soldier time that's needed to support that would have gone into if these were traditionally generator-powered. Capturing all of this, the Army has its own net zero energy installation effort. Many of you from Congress realize that there's a large list of mandates that the services have to meet from EPAC and ESA, executive order, and NDAA from our authorizing committees. And what we in the Army have decided to do in terms of how we address goal compliance is we are pushing a net zero installation, net zero approach, which uses holistic integrated design, looks at all of the systems on your installation, energy, waste, and water, to gain efficiencies and convert what might have previously been a waste stream into a resource stream. And we believe that if we do that, we give the Army installation and senior commanders the desired end state, a sustainable community, that they will reach that end state, and in the process they will meet all of their energy mandates that we have from Congress and from the White House. So I'll just wrap it up there, and I look forward to taking any questions that we have over the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you, Richard. That was terrific. And thank you for pointing out that we've got some great leaders from in this field from across parts of our government here with us, and I know from the Army we also have John Powers, who's joined us, who works with Richard Kidd in the Army Secretariat and has also been a leader in this area. And I see also in the back of the room Esther McClure, who also serves in DOD, one of the great leaders here in energy and environment as well. Now we're going to hear from Drew Sloan, who's a veteran, who served in Afghanistan, been at the pointy edge of the spear, and knows what it's like to have to convoy fuel to the front and have your troops' lives put at risk because of energy inefficiencies. He's now taken that military experience and West Point education, as well as Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School, and is deploying it in O-Power, a leading energy efficiency company. Drew.
Sherry, thank you for letting me be on this panel, and I'm very happy to be here. Richard, thank you for saying a lot what I was going to say, so this will be a little bit interesting. As Sherry mentioned, I was an infantry officer, served from 2002 to 2007. Served in Afghanistan, and then in Iraq in 06. And so I think what my role in this panel is to do is to sort of speak about what this means to people, to actual soldiers serving in combat right now. And so I'm going to do that, and then I think I'm actually going to try to touch a little bit more on sort of the culture change aspect that Richard mentioned, because I think that, combined with the operational things, really what makes energy and what the military is doing with energy really, really exciting. So the first thing, what it means to the soldiers downrange. The best way I can kind of describe that is kind of give a little story about when I was in Afghanistan in 2004. We were out on a mission, and it was about a three-week mission. In Afghanistan, you don't actually have to go that far to be a really long way away from everybody else. And so we were out for about 3 weeks, and that was going to require a couple resupplies. And so we were just about as far as we were going to go, about a day and a half away from a resupply, when all of a sudden sandstorms came in and closed down the airfields in Kandahar and Bagram. At that point in time, those were really the only two airfields that were resupplying anything for anybody in Afghanistan. And so we were kind of stuck. And the next day came, and we were supposed to get the resupply, and the airfields were still closed, and so no resupply. So now we are kind of stuck with what we have, and we have been using it at a pace that we thought was normal because we had sort of come to rely on these resupplies, and that was no longer happening. And so we sort of started to run out of fuel. We started to run out of the ability to drive our Humvees, to refill our generators. And if you don't refill the generator, then the batteries that you have stop. You can't recharge those. And so by that time already used up all the extra batteries that you've been carrying around in your pack. So it really vividly displays this sort of being tethered to a supply chain. And what's exciting what the military is doing now, I'll give a story about the 116th Infantry. It's a battalion out of Fort Riley, Kansas that just deployed to Afghanistan in May. And when they did, the Army sent them with several new types of power generators, so to speak. So one of them is runs on local propane that can be bought from a local economy. Another one is a solar blanket that you can use to power these batteries. And the reaction from soldiers has been very, very positive. To quote a staff sergeant, a sergeant first class, Jason Snell, he's a platoon sergeant, which means he's about in charge of about 40 people. To quote him, he says, this is an excellent system. It allows much more flexibility to units in a wide range of operating environments. It would allow the sustainment of a small operating team to maintain most small electronics for a longer period of time without resupply. And that right there, I think, is, we're talking about batteries. So there's still a lot of other stuff that you've got to be resupplied for. One of those is how you refill your vehicles. But this right here represents a starting point. And it's a place where the Army has provided alternatives to the status quo. This is the way it's always been, but now this is the way it's going to be. And as soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, as they start to experience this, it creates a mental shift in their mind. And the idea that there are different ways to go about doing things. And that, I think, is really, really critical, because right now we're just starting with batteries. But as soldiers get more accustomed to these sort of substitutes and alternatives working in batteries, they're going to be more likely, and the Army's going to be more likely to test out other things. Things that can really move us towards cutting that supply tail off and making us more operationally independent and resilient when those resupply trains just don't come in. So I think operationally, that's sort of the middle ship that we're looking for. Richard talked about commanders want a choice. I think Americans also want a choice. And what you have with soldiers who have sort of made this middle shift overseas, when they come home, that's where this the culture change piece comes into it. And so I work for a company called O-Power. We're based out of Arlington, Virginia. We are an energy efficiency company. And we're labeled as a behavior-based energy efficiency company because the whole point of our existence is to sort of create a mini culture change within each individual household to use their energy resources more productively. And that's really what I think, in large ways, what DOD is doing with this whole energy plan, is that they're creating mini culture changes within our forces so that when they come home, they're going to be less accepting of the status quo as it is. If you take the current oil crisis, what we just had, and the high gas prices, I got the opportunity to testify in front of the House Natural Resources Committee in May about, you know, what are we going to do with rising gas prices? And the answer kept coming back from one major constituent was, well, we're going to use more oil. We're going to drill more oil, and that's going to be our solution out of this. That's basically doing the same thing that you've always done, just trying to like double down on that system. And I think what you're going to find with a lot of soldiers coming back is that that's not good enough. That if the Army has given them something, or the Marines have given them something, or the Navy has given them something that works in theater but does something a different way, uses a different fuel, uses a renewable fuel, they're not going to be comfortable coming back and being told, well, no, you have to pay high gas prices and we're just going to try to find more of the same. So more of the same isn't going to be good enough. And I think right there, that's where you get into this idea where DOD really can be sort of a leader in social change. Richard hinted on it in many of the ways that the Army is sort of, the military is sort of led. I think back, the biggest one in my mind is desegregation and how when the services were integrated, soldiers sort of served together of different races, the system didn't fall apart, and then when they went back out, they were less, you know, their tolerance levels had gone way up, and that sort of permeated through a lot of society because the military at its heart is a microcosm of the rest of America. And so when you make this middle change here in the Army or in the military as a whole, you're going to make it in the rest of society because those soldiers, those sailors, airmen, Marines, they're going to go back out and they're going to change their behavior. Their behavior is already going to be changed. They're going to be more accepting of substitutes, of alternatives, and they're going to be less willing sort of settle for the status quo. So that, I think, right there is the most fundamentally exciting thing. And what's exciting for me personally is that it's already kind of happening. One of the groups that is sponsoring this event today is called Operation Free. And Operation Free is nothing more than a collection of veterans that think we need to create a new, more sensible approach to our energy use. And when Operation was Free was founded in 2000, I think it was 2009, they expected to get 100 veterans over 6 months. And they got 150 in 6 weeks. And within a month of creation, they were at the White House. And then they were driving around on a biodiesel bus and did a 300 town hall meetings across the country, kind of spreading this message that there's a national security sort of concern with the way we're using energy now. And they've seen it as soldiers, as ways that you can sort of do things differently. And they've seen the importance behind doing things differently. And that right there is really the fundamental piece. So it starts with small batteries out in Afghanistan. And I think it's going to lead to a major change across the United States. And I think DOD is really going to be at the forefront of that change. So I look forward to your questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Drew, for sharing your personal and combat experiences with us. And now we're joined by another veteran and military leader, Vice Admiral Denny McGinn. In 2006, CNA formed the CNA Military Advisory Board, which since that time has produced three important reports. At least one of which I see floating around here now, on energy security, energy innovation, and climate change and national security. And they have helped lead this field, I believe, in outlining the security threats from energy and climate change, as well as providing a roadmap for some of the ways in which we can, the services and our nation can see a better way forward. And no one has become a better spokesman for those efforts than Vice Admiral McGinn, who himself served, can I say how many years you've actually served here, Denny?
A couple, sure.
just a few. And over his many years of service, he had many tours of duty at sea and ashore and in many different leadership positions. And since his service, he's worked tirelessly across a range of organizations on these issues, really become a national treasure, and now he is also president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thirty-five years goes by pretty quick in that service to our nation. This has been a great panel, and I'm privileged to be a part of it. We've heard some consistent messages that I'd just like to reinforce. First of all, this is really at the heart of our national security in the broadest definition. Why else would the Department of Defense and our armed services be doing what you just heard just a sample of were it not directly related to our national security? And it's directly related to our national security in a way that we on the CNA Military Advisory Board talked about in our report on energy and our national security, powering America's defense. We said in a very unambiguous way that our energy posture in this country constitutes a serious and urgent threat to our national security militarily, diplomatically, and economically. And further, that this vulnerability, primarily an over-reliance and a growing reliance on fossil fuel, can be exploited by those who would wish to do the United States harm. Another way of saying that is that we in America are not in control of our energy future. We are here in the Capitol Visitor Center, and there's a lot of buzz going around the Capitol about our national debt and deficits and debt ceiling limits and all of these important issues. The clock is ticking, but it's ticking not just till the 2nd of August. It's ticking every single day that goes by. Between now and the 2nd of August, when hopefully we'll have a deal in place, we are going to spend $6 billion out of our economy to pay for our addiction to oil. And we will spend $1 billion every day that we continue in a business as usual way. This is at the heart of our national security, especially our economic security and future prosperity. The armed services, and you just heard from some great leaders in these armed services, really get it. On the military advisory board, we consist of a bunch of 3- and 4-star retired generals and admirals from all 4 military services, collectively more than 400 years of service to our nation in uniform. Been there, done that, we've got the t-shirts. And we collectively looked at this over a period of analysis of 15 months, talking to the global experts on energy, economy, technology, and came up with this unambiguous conclusion, serious and urgent threat. So what's needed? Well, as has been pointed out most by our most recent speaker, Drew Sloan, this is a problem that is being addressed by the Department of Defense. And we need to support the Department of Defense, whether it's through authorization bills or appropriations bills. We should not stand in their way as they move ahead into a great leadership position for the rest of the United States. As far as the rest of our economy and our society, we should listen carefully and observe and learn and adopt the things that the military is doing today. and listen to the veterans with the messages that they bring back from Afghanistan and Iraq. What are those lessons? We cannot continue in a business as usual manner. There is great opportunity in the military context to increase mission effectiveness. The services aren't deploying clean energy technology in Afghanistan to win any type of EPA award. They should, they probably will, but the reason is it increases their mission effectiveness, it saves lives. Soldiers and Marines are not getting killed at the rate they would be if we continue just total reliance on fossil fuel. Every gallon of fuel that we can eliminate the use of without diminishing in any way mission effectiveness at the forward edge saves lives, takes people off the road, takes convoys off the road, increases our mission effectiveness. Our economic security is clearly in the forefront in the debate that's going on up here on Capitol Hill. Well, as we look to ways to deal with that economic security by reducing our deficit, cutting spending, we need to do that very, very carefully. Because I would contend that investments in the form of government incentives, and whether it's for good programs like we've heard from the Army and the Navy today, and DOD overall, or whether it's for mid to medium-sized companies that are entering or already in the clean technology business, whether it's energy efficiency like Old Power or renewable energy in all forms, these are investments that we would be very, very wrong-headed to try in the interest of cutting, to remove, because they will, in a very direct and very short-term way, actually increase our economic vitality, create jobs, and be the kind of stimulus that will cause us to be more prosperous and, in the national security context, a much more secure nation. We see from the leadership of the Department of Defense the technology spin out, the market certainty that the demand for commercial off-the-shelf clean energy technology pulls. We need to make sure that we in America start adopting this culture. And to quote a former Army commander, company commander, who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, in the 21st century, we should make solar panels, windmills, and energy efficiency the same thing as the victory gardens of World War II. Thanks a lot, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Denny. We'll now take questions. Please raise your hand. Please identify yourself, name, and organization. And Carol, are we using mics or people just...
People can just stand up.
Okay. Right.
Thank you very much. I'm really impressed with what everybody had to say. My name is Michael Harold from Congressman Blue Marrow's office. You're talking about the need to... I mean, essentially, saving fuel saves lives, and the need to take fuel convoys off the road. And I believe it was General Mattis in a memo recently said around 75% of marine energy goes to HVAC for operational energy. And I know that in Iraq, we did spend a decent amount of money on technology that exists to save money for installations using spray foam insulation, and we're using 60-70% of your energy on HVACs to heat and cool temporary installations. Are we going to see from the Army and Marines and others spray foam used in Afghanistan or something similar to save energy from HVACs?
Let me take this.
I can take
this. As a fellow Oregonian, I should take this,
right? I'll defer to you as senior service, but I don't feel like to.
I feel like I'm on the 50-yard line of the Army-Navy.
First of all, I just caution some of your figures. I don't think that those percentages are correct, okay?
The Army uses 32% of all its energy on generators, and the generators provide electricity for a plethora of activities, okay? Communications, water purification, heating and cooling, all right? So I don't think the numbers there are an accurate reflection, and there's a lot of figures out there. On spray foam or any other technology, it's not a specific technology, all right? And you know, people often focus on, well, solar panels will solve all our problems, or this will solve all our problems. No, it's a holistic integrated approach that will solve all of our problems, where we look at the cascading benefits of one technology and how it leads to ever more benefits downrange. Down the stream of other technologies. We, the Army, think that between efficiency improvements, microgrid power management, better insulation, we can get about 30 to 40% energy reduction on our forward operating basis. You add in renewables and we're about 60%. If we were to do all of that, that represents about 15% of our total fuel burden in Afghanistan. And that's pretty significant. And that's with technologies that exist today. Also, when you do technologies, though, whether it's overseas or here, you've got to look at your full life cycle cost analysis. And when do they break even? No one's here to waste money, all right? I think the proposition is we could become more energy secure and save money in the process. But some of these technologies have some end-of-life disposal cost issues that have to be factored in at the upfront and considered when we take a look at solutions.
So let me just add on to Richard's comment. And the spray foam specifically, I think an interesting technology with in certain applications. So in a Camp Leatherneck, you know, I might be able to use it there, but for a truly expeditionary environment, it doesn't really lend itself to that environment. You can't really fold it up and take it with you and move. But what we have done, and in part in partnership with the Army, but also as I referred to before with our with the Marine Corps and their expeditionary forward operating base, their XFOB work that they've done, those technologies that I mentioned we brought in, I just kind of rattled through a few of them, but I didn't go through all the specifics of what they actually returned, but on average, 30 to 90% energy savings. That's a big range, and it depends on the application that they're used in. But really looking at LEDs, the solar blankets that Richard mentioned, renewable energy generators, so really trying to take out every piece of energy out of theater. And that's made them more expeditionary. And now we're taking those lessons learned that we got from India Company 3-5, and in part because there's an incredible demand now within the Marine Corps to take this out to other forward operating bases within Afghanistan. And we're now going to take this out. We're going to spend roughly, well, it's going to be less than $40 million. It will pay for itself. It will save $50 million a year or more and take that out across all six battalions in Afghanistan. And so that's some of the work that's ongoing. And that work continues with some other innovations going on in the Marine Corps.
If I could just add, in the Afghanistan context, back in February and March, I got a picture from Colonel Bob Charette, who runs the Marine Corps' Office of Expeditionary Energy. And it was from one of the forward operating bases where some of these fixed solar panels were reducing the electricity demand for generators by significant amounts. In some cases, as Tom said, up to 90%. And the picture was of a solar array. So, okay, I've seen a solar array. And you look closely, and it didn't look quite symmetrical. What had happened was they had come under attack at the forward operating base by rocket-propelled grenades. And some of the grenade fragments actually hit the solar panels. And the Marines didn't know that had happened, that damage had occurred, because the electricity kept flowing. I'm sure it had degraded, you know, a couple percent less efficient and all of that stuff. But think about this. What if that had been a diesel generator set that got hit by those grenade fragments? Pretty big explosion right inside a compound that probably would have killed some Marines, and it would have certainly knocked out a good portion of their electricity. So there are benefits
that double and triple and quadruple across the mission spectrum of our armed forces, especially overseas, when we can make these types of renewable energy and energy efficiency investments. And we can't get it there fast enough from my perspective.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. In the back?
Hi, I'm Lisa Rice, Congressman Ross from Arkansas. I'd just like to pick up on what you both said. Last week, some of the press coverage from the combined Air Force Army Energy Forum seemed to pit a competition between the Army and the Marines over the use of these renewables. Can you talk about how they're complementary to maybe how do you, what are you doing to the lessons learned from the different vendors that are being used and the different types of equipment that you are using in the field?
I'll start this time. I'll think maybe prerogative here, but I know they're working very closely together. In fact, the just to give an example, the most recent solicitation that we put out for the XFOB, and this is kind of an ongoing. We'll do this every year. We'll invite industry in to learn about their technologies. We're doing that in concert with the Army. In fact, we're using the Army's contracting office to actually run that program for the Marine Corps. I know there's a lot of lessons learned being shared, not just in a very detailed way, and we're working very closely with the Army to share what we're doing, share what's working, what the technologies are, and what the innovations that we're seeing. So I invite Richard to add any other comments, but I know there was a very direct linkage between, as Denny mentioned, Colonel Charette and the Expeditionary Energy Office and their counterparts in the Army.
Yeah, I'm checking my BlackBerry so I get the citation correctly. I get asked this question, and so National Defense Magazine and National Defense Magazine blog, the title of the article is that Army denies green competition. So I think I'll just let my remarks in that sort of stand on this. You know, there's nothing we'd like more than to see a net zero Marine infantry battalion so that we can shamelessly copy everything they've done.
Right. And I'll say, as a former OSD official, nothing I liked more was to have a good little friendly competition among the military services, because you always got better results that way. So it's the spirit of American competitiveness that's enabled us to maintain military superiority and be a leading economic and global nation. So keep on it, guys. Okay, Andrew Holland, I know you had your hand up back there.
Thanks, Jerry. Andrew Holland, the American Security Project. I hear a lot of talk about energy efficiency from all of you, I think. But that only gets us so far. My question is what role does the DoD have and the services have in developing next generation energy technologies, stuff like next generation biofuels or fusion reactors to replace nuclear reactors on the aircraft carriers or anything like that?
The title of this gathering was driven by a report from the Defense Science Board in 2008, which basically made some recommendations about things the DoD and all those services could do to consider the fully burdened cost of fuel, or you could substitute for fuel energy, in making procurement decisions. With the appointment of Sharon Burke as the Assistant Secretary for Operational Energy, this is really starting to take place. There's much more focus and coordination going on in the Pentagon about defining what the true costs, the life cycle costs, costs of ownership of various pieces of military equipment are coming down the road especially. Now, that's not to say there isn't any focus on the force that we have and the force structure and equipment that we have, but I think that you'll see more and more, as I believe Senator Udall quoted Mike Mullen,
this is really all about really thinking about energy first when we start making decisions about future capabilities. And I think that that will certainly continue. I'd also like to mention that as we make decisions for the force of the future, energy choices, there's going to be some great opportunities to spin in and spin out energy efficiency and renewable energy technology, things that are developed perhaps for heavy hauling trucks on our interstate system, maybe developing hybrid systems that directly could be used through TARDEC and other organizations to actually produce military equipment that that benefits from that. By the same token, as the military with compelling needs, working under the terms of the MOU that Richard Kidd mentioned earlier, develops great solutions from DOE and across the federal R&D structure, that can benefit society directly as so many things in the past have.
And I would just add to that, Andrew, that, you know, I mean, if you look historically, the Department of Defense, I think Richard may have mentioned this, I mean, has really played a leading role in the development of technologies. You know, you look at GPS technologies that have led to unmanned systems, battery technologies, and so on, that they've played that pivotal role in making those technologies available. In many of those cases, there's been very much commercial interest and appetite for those technologies once developed. On the topic of advanced alternative fuels, I think that's another area where government can play a role in that. We clearly have an appetite for having fuels that aren't as price volatile as what we have today. We see what's going on, whether it's halfway around the globe in the political unrest in some countries that provide fuel. We see what's going on in just in terms of the overall price of fuel increasing. And we know there's an opportunity there to really look more within, to look within the government or look within this country to provide a portion of those needs. And I think that's an area where the government and specifically DOD can play a role in leading the making of that market. You know, certainly, you know, as you look at DOD, if we were an airline, we would be a big airline, just to put it in perspective. We'd be the biggest airline, but we would be a big airline. But my point is, we have an ability to help really move this market and accelerate the development of it. But we also are going to need to do, you know, we're going to need to look to partners in the commercial sector as well to be there. And they're stepping up. Increasingly, they're stepping up, announcing their needs and goals as it relates to alternative fuels. But really, this is about, you know, finding domestic sources of fuel that we can use to, in our case, to power the fleet, to enhance our energy security, our energy independence, and hopefully make the beginning of a more energy efficient economy in this country. Thanks.
Yes. Stuart Boss, Climate Progress. I sort of have two questions. The first is, to what extent is mitigating climate change part of all these goals and initiatives that DOD is working on? And then also wondering if any of you can comment on legislative attacks on some of these initiatives, like Section 526, and what's motivating that?
I'll take the first one. You want 526?
Sure.
Sure. I mean, in terms of climate change, most of the focus has been driven by Executive Order 13514 and the requirement to cut greenhouse gas emissions. So the Department of Defense's target is a 34% reduction. And so the focus on energy efficiency and deployment of renewables should allow us to get to that or get pretty close to that in our current plans and trajectory. And the other attributes of the executive order, sustainable procurement. In the Army, the net zero initiative is intended to actually go beyond that, where we take a systems of systems approach and try for radical and significant reductions. And we've had some pretty significant successes already in water, and we're looking to what we can see in the private sector. I mean, if NREL's still here, you know, DOE built the largest net zero building in the world out at NREL, and they did it at cost, comparable cost to a building at code. You've got communities around the world that are reducing their energy and water consumption and almost eliminating their waste. So we know it can be done, or pretty close, or close to it. at a break-even point without spending exorbitant amounts of money.
And I'll take the second piece.
But we do it, we're not doing it because of climate change. We're doing it because of mission. And when we talk about energy, waste, and water, the important thing for the Army is that the installation commanders of tomorrow have the same choices of the installation of commanders of today. They have to have access to energy, water, and land to perform their mission. And we've got to take steps today to make sure that they have that choice.
And I would just say, just on that first point, I think as you look at something that really guides the DoD and the creation and implementation of our plans and budgets, the Quadrennial Defense Review actually speaks directly toward that topic on climate change. It really sees climate change as an accelerant to risks that we might have. And so I think looked at that way, I mean, that's it's not the thing that we address first and foremost. I mean, for us, it's about warfighting capability. It's about saving money, saving lives. But that's certainly one of those second-order effects that we're looking at. Specific to the question on 526, I would just say 526 to date, and I would suspect into the future, has not been a hindrance to DoD and our ability to purchase fuels. I think, you know, as you look at what industry is doing, whether it's in part because of the tax credits that might be available, maybe the goodness of their hearts, I don't know, but they are responding with fuels that have a life cycle greenhouse gas emissions equal to or less than petroleum in general. So I don't see 526, hasn't been to date, I don't see that being a hindrance into the future. And I guess I'd point folks toward, I think it was a very well-written blog by Assistant Secretary Sharon Burke, I think it was 15 July in a White House blog, that really kind of talked about that. And I think I'd refer folks to that because I think it really lays out the issues of why we'd like to, you know, that legislation hasn't been a problem today, and why its repeal would be potentially problematic.
I'd like to add an industry perspective. If you're an investor or a company, large, medium, or small, and you want to be in a part of a growth industry like biofuels, there's nothing like having a stable policy so that it creates what we call market certainty. In other words, I know that I can invest in the commercial scale-up of this biofuels company, whether it's algal fuel or biodiesel, or a new feedstock, a new enzyme to convert cellulosic ethanol, or whatever it is, having that market certainty is really, really important. And because 526 narrowed the choices of new fuels appropriately to the biofuel area, the sustainable, renewable area, it really has provided a very powerful market signal that all of the services, but in particular the Air Force and the Navy, are benefiting from by having greater quantities of biofuel choices available for doing the drop-in testing that they are doing so well across all of their platforms. So this is good for America. Tom mentioned earlier, we are effectively a small airline. And to the extent that these biofuel companies scale up to commercial and beyond scale, that provides choices for the United States civil sector that are really, really good and help to break gallon by gallon, percent by percent, our addiction to petroleum-based fuel.
Okay. Gentlemen in the middle, back there, and then woman.
Yes. My name is Harold Seiler. I'm with the Organic Carbon Action Alliance. And I come down here to express my views to my congressmen and senators on budget cuts. To what extent are proposed budget cuts to affect the ability of DOD to meet its new mission, the green mission of energy efficiency and energy conservation?
Since I am retired and I can speak fairly freely, I will say it potentially could be disastrous, because if some of the great programs that have been started in partnership between the armed services, DOD at large, and industry to carve out a new direction, a more sustainable, better for our economy, better for our national security direction, that if those programs are undercut, either by
some onerous restriction or regulation in the authorization language or in cutting out the essential appropriations to carry out the very, very relevant and important plans that the services have. That would be bad. It would be bad for our men and women in uniform that are over there in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, and it would be bad in the longer term for our future military capabilities and indeed for our country's economic prosperity.
Yeah, let me say that on that point, I think that these programs, by and large, particularly the energy programs, are going to be saving the military department's money in an era of declining defense budgets. So it would be penny-wise and pound foolish to cut too deeply. They're not big money programs in the total hundreds of billions of dollars of DOD's defense budget. But I'd say to you congressional staffers that funding in programs like the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program and the Energy Security Technology Certification Program and the Energy Conservation Improvement Program that Senator Udall mentioned, ESIP, these are all small targeted. The first two are R&D programs, the second one's in MILCON, and each of the services have some modest amounts of funding that are going to allow them to make both these breakthrough, both technology and operating process improvement changes that are very critical for our future. Yes?
I can't really comment on the budget discussions, but I can just comment that Congress has given us tools, particularly on the facility side, authorities in regards to energy savings, performance contracts, power purchase agreements, enhanced use leases, that could serve as models to continue the deployment of energy efficiency and renewable technologies across the services going forward. So those authorities could be expanded. The budget scoring rules could be looked at again. And we could look for ways to capture efficiencies in the operational side where fuel savings could be used to pay for those efficiencies. So if budgets get really tight, there are some alternatives. We'll probably work with Congress to see if we can expand those existing authorities to cover other aspects. So there are some other options out there.
Yeah, and I'll just say, without getting into the specifics, we're putting a lot into those, into our programs on energy, both tactically and for our shore facilities. And I think as was mentioned, and we're counting on those savings. I mean, those savings that we'll get from those programs will allow us, if you want to put it in terms, to buy more things that we need, whether it's a new ship, whether it's a new aircraft, whether it's, additional readiness that we need. It'll allow us to do that. And in an era of declining budgets, that's really important to have a stream of savings that you can count on. And those are the things that can be put in at risk if we look to, cut those opportunities.
Okay. Woman in the back, then gentlemen, a couple rows forward. And I think given the time, we're going to take these couple last. We'll take the questions and then let the panel answer all of them. So I see one, two, and I see a third hand over here.
Thank you very much. I wanted to pick up on that conversation earlier about DOD's role in pulling next generation technology and serving as a first customer and validator. For Richard Pitt specifically, you mentioned the sources sought motives and you mentioned the net zero installation initiative. Can you talk about how, if at all, these two things are connected and whether for private companies who would like to offer up technologies or systems and support the net zero initiative, whether the sources sought, the procurements that come out of that can be a vehicle to deploy new technologies at individual installations.
Okay. Gentleman here.
James Warner from the Fuel Cell and Hydrogen Energy Association. I'm very excited about the agreement between the DOE and DOD to bring fuel cells for backup power to military bases across the country. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the services see fuel cells and hydrogen as part of what's going to help the services meet their mission.
Okay, gentlemen.
Steve Bruckner, I'm with Sierra Club, Virginia Capture. Questions primarily for Tom, but about initiative with wind energy, in particular, your initiatives to do long-term power purchase agreements with either onshore or offshore wind facilities.
Okay, were there any other last questions before we let the panel? Okay, gentlemen in the back.
Who are you and where are you from?
I'm sorry, Eric Lindeman, the Energy Daily and James Defense. You mentioned an RFP, the largest RFP for advanced biofuels, and I apologize for the writing and I didn't really hear what you said about that. That's the first question. The second question has to do with the Army uses 32% of its power goes to generators. And in a conversation with Ms. Hammock not too long ago, I think she told me, I may not remember this correctly, that generators in the Army run on JP-8 and that sometimes, and that often the used generator fuel, the JP-8, is that filtered, used oil from the cooking facility is then filtered in with the JP-8. If you could clarify that for me, that's great.
Okay, I think what we'll do, given the time, since it is the end of the panel, we'll just go down the panel, starting with Tom, and answer the last four questions and any concluding remarks you'd like to make. We'll give our veteran the last words. He hasn't had too many.
Great. I'll just respond to the questions, but before that, I'll just say thank you to you all for being here. Look forward. Thanks for the questions and the ability to be here. Thank you, Sharon, or Sherry as well, for setting this up. So maybe just kind of going backwards, I took some notes here just to answer Eric's question about to clarify my remarks on the largest purchase. That was a DLA Energy, I believe, about 2 weeks ago or so, put out a request on our behalf to purchase 450,000 gallons of advanced biofuels. And so that's one that's out on the street now, has not been closed up yet and not yet awarded. But we believe that represents one of the largest, if not the largest, and again, sorry for the being ambiguous there, but there's not a lot of, I guess when you're leading these areas, there's not a lot of places you can go to cite the information, but one of the largest advanced biofuels purchases in the world. On the gentleman from Sierra Club on the wind energy, long-term PPAs, that is something that we are exploring in other avenues where power purchase agreements are a really effective tool for the military to use, and we're looking at that in a variety of applications. As it relates to offshore wind, we can go as far as 30-year power purchase agreements, but at the end of the day, that power over that 30 years really needs to be kind of a net neutral from a cost perspective to the government. I mean, I think if we're to entertain something that's significantly above net neutral over a 30-year contract, for example, that's something we're just going to have to take on a case-by-case basis. But I think that ideally, you know, over 30 years, we could pay more in the near term and get a return on the back end if that was able to do. But I think, you know, in this era of declining budgets, I think what's, you know, the easiest sell is going to be having a net neutral agreement over 30 years. But we're certainly interested in those technologies where they don't interfere with our missions or other services' missions. Fuel cells, I think we're putting a lot of effort into fuel cells are within the Office of Naval Research and the Naval Research Lab. We've put a number of efforts there looking for those. We have hydrogen itself as a fuel. We have some pilot programs going on in San Diego and I believe in Hawaii to use hydrogen-based fuel for some vehicles. So I think we are an active participant in that in the our research and development of fuel cell technology. I think it's an important source for the future. And then the last piece is just to provide some information. One of the things that we did over the last couple months is we engaged the venture capital community through a process that the Office of Secretary of Defense runs called DaVinci. And through that process, we identified I think we had 161 companies that came to us with their technologies that we could use on our installations. And from that, I think we got down to about 30 that we invited to come in to talk to our installations across the Marines and the Navy. And from that, we're going to have 5 to 10 of those technologies that we're going to actually test on our facilities coming up over the next year. And so that's been a very effective program. We're looking to do some similar outreach efforts so that we can stay on that cutting edge of innovation, what's going on in DoD. And that's an effort that we, you know, while we was something that we ran, but we also had representatives from the Army, from the Air Force, from OSD, and other agencies to participate in that with us because we thought it was important for folks to be exposed to these innovative technologies. So with that, I'll close and turn over to Denny. Thanks.
I would just close by saying that we are not in control of our energy security. Now and in the future, we continue business as usual. The programs that we've discussed today and others like them that are being led by the Department of Defense and the Military Services are starting to get us back in control in small incremental ways of our energy future security. What we need is to recognize that the clock is running, that we need to make sure we get the kinds of policies in place to not only accelerate and expand the efforts of the military services in terms of our energy security, but to also have the kinds of policies in place that will expand that security envelope to include our economic security across the country. We need to have the kind of stable policy that takes a look, what do we want to look like 10 years down the road, not 1 year down the road, so that when we are looking back to 2011, we can say, boy, are we ever glad that we put that policy into place at the federal level, because we are a much more secure and a much more prosperous nation for having had that foresight.
All right. Thanks. Well, first of all, Sherry, thanks for having me, and everyone, thanks for your attention. I'll just sort of go in the order. Comment about, I mean, the short answer to the question about is there opportunities for technologies in the net zero installations, and is that linked to the RFI, the answer is yes. Okay, I mean, that there's a considered acquisition strategy and planning effort to make sure that we go forward on the that we bring in the best that we can in terms of the net zero installations. I mean, a comment on DoD and technology. It's not DoD's mission to do the basic scientific research on energy technologies. That's for the Department of Energy and the private sector and others. When we get to the place where we're going to deploy it, then we just need to make sure we have a couple of obligations, you know, to make sure that we're not redundant in our efforts. So it's great that there's this rivalry between the Army and the Marine Corps. We know what we're doing, what each other's doing. What would be worse is if rather than stealing each other's technology, we were spending all sorts of money to develop the same thing. Okay? So we've got a special obligation to eliminate redundancy within the department and with the other agencies. Okay? On the technology, I suspect some of the technologies that are going to cross over to the energy field from the Department of Defense, we're not going to see coming. All right? And I'll put forth my hypothesis that it's going to be sensors. All right. Years ago, forward-looking infrared radar was $100,000 to $200,000 a pop. They were embedded in a missile, and we flew it at the enemy, and it blew up. You can buy that same technology today for about $1,000 in a video camera that you can use to do a sweep on your building to see where it's leaking heat. We're now getting to the point for a couple of bucks, we can put a sensor on anything that changes temperature, moves, or vibrates. If you think about that connected to a network, you're going to get an energy awareness on a scale you haven't seen in the past. And so that sensor technology and the cost is being driven by the Department of Defense. Again, wasn't designed to have anything to do with energy, but it's going to have huge attendant positive benefits on the energy side. Fuel cells and hydrogen, lots of potential. I think it's extremely unlikely that you're going to get a separate hydrogen supply chain in the military. I say that though recognizing we already have one for our lighter than air, but for energy, we're probably not going to want to haul hydrogen across Afghanistan. So in a tactical environment, fuel cells that take JP8, convert it back, or any fossil fuel, convert it to its primary components and then work with that. It's probably more appealing. Tri-gen, which produces electricity, heat, and water, is an appealing technology in an operational environment. Sierra Club Wind, yes, we like long-term power purchase agreements for wind, but because the cost of wind is coming down, they don't have to be that long anymore. And yes, the Army generators, Army issue generators use JP8. We have one fuel in the supply chain for very good reasons. A lot of our contractors and other entities that we find in the forward operating base or in the battle space use diesel generators. We have a number of programs in the Army where we are, again, going back to that whole systems integrated design, where we are taking waste from our dining facilities and converting it into a biodiesel product that can then be blended with the current diesel to run those commercial generators. What's really exciting about this is not only does it save cost in terms of fuel displacement, it saves cost in terms of backhaul. You don't have to figure out a solution for thousands and thousands of gallons of fryer grease in the middle of Iraq or Afghanistan because you can do something else with it. And that's just another one of those benefits from that integrated design mentality.
To wrap it up on my end, I think that what we've talked about today is the dramatic importance this has both for people in the field, for soldiers in the field, and also for Americans back home. And I would just speak to those of you who are here on behalf of your congressman. The debate on how to reduce our dependence on oil or how to bring down gas prices was relatively acrimonious here in Congress, and it didn't really go anywhere. There's two very different ideologies. This is a way to bring down the price of oil. Supporting DOD in this mission, giving them the resources to kind of take a lot of these new technologies and that may cost a little more than what's acceptable in the civilian market, but because of these other concerns we have in terms of energy security, in terms of operational security, might be willing to pay a little bit more to test them out, to create alternatives. That really is how I think we are going to move not just the military, but America to a place where we have more control over our energy security, which leads to more control of our national security, which in turn leads to more control over economic security. So I cannot, as a veteran and as somebody who's in this industry, I cannot advocate strongly enough for the importance of this and the ramifications that this has really on not just the military, but on America and her citizens. Thank you.
Let's thank all the panel.